This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about something that we have discussed before on the show, but not in quite a long time, and that is the politics of Northern Ireland. Earlier this month, a report was issued by a joint commission of the British and the Irish governments that declared that the Irish Republican Army was no longer a threat to peace in Northern Ireland. At the same time, many Protestant politicians said that they remained unconvinced that the IRA had abandoned its armed struggle. On the program this morning, we'll be looking at the current state of politics in Ireland as we talk with Ed Maloney. He's a reporter who has covered Northern Ireland since 1978. He has worked for a number of publications. He's been the Northern editor of the Irish Times, the Northern editor of the Sunday Tribune in Dublin. He co-authored a biography of the Reverend Ian Paisley. It was published in 1986 and then was republished in 2007 in the wake of the power-sharing agreement in Northern Ireland. He's contributed to several other books, including a study of media coverage of the violence in Northern Ireland. He's written for a wide range of papers and magazines in the U.S. and Britain. Just to name a few, The Post, The Washington Post, The New York Post, Economist, Independent, The Guardian, New Statesman. He is currently North American correspondent for the Sunday Times magazine in London. He's been frequent commentator on BBC, CNN, and other radio and television in Britain and Ireland. He is currently working and living in New York, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome here on the program. The only thing we ask people is that they're just brief in their comments, but certainly anyone can call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Mr. Maloney, hello.
Hello, Dave. How are you?
Fine. Thanks. And yourself?
Grand.
Great.
Grand.
Thanks for giving us some of your time.
No problem.
We certainly appreciate it. Just as a way of starting, I suppose, this report that we've talked about here and this commission, this is a commission that's been periodically issuing reports on what's been happening in Northern Ireland, giving its opinions. And I think I looked at some of the report, and the members of the commission do, in fact, say that this is their opinion. I would hope that it would be an informed opinion. Just who constitutes this commission?
Well, it's a mixture of people. As a former Northern Ireland party leader who led a sort of moderate middle of the road type party, and then there are former security people. There's a guy who used to be head of the Scotland Yard anti-terrorist squad, and there's also someone from the American side. The Americans contributed to this body as well, and the official is a former senior person in the CIA, now retired. And they were set up about 2 or 3 years ago to issue regular reports because there was a need for an independent, if you like, judgment as to whether or not groups like the IRA were really still up to their old tricks or not. They were set up to try and answer that question, and they've issued reports on a regular basis about all the various armed groups in Northern Ireland, both Republican, of course the IRA is the largest one, but not the only one, and the various loyalist ones, giving their judgment as to who was responsible for what and to what extent they are still active and so on and so forth. And they are entirely dependent, and this is, I think, you know, an interesting aspect of the whole story. They are entirely dependent upon the intelligence wings of the British and the Irish governments for their information. They don't have an independent intelligence gathering function at all. They get their information from British intelligence, from MI5. They get it from the police special branch, which is the equivalent of the FBI, who monitor political crime of one sort or another, and they also get their information from the Irish equivalent of those bodies as well. So they're independent, but they're dependent, if you like, mm-hmm. on others for their information.
Well, I'd like to ask you about your thoughts on the conclusions of this most recent report. And I have some section of it here in front of me, and they pose a number of questions, and I suppose that they are the good basic questions to ask. And let me ask you and see how you respond and to what they said. But the basic question, I suppose, is this, to quote from the report, is the provisional IRA committed to following an exclusively political path? And according to the commission report, they say, we are convinced that it is. Do you think that it is?
I don't know. I don't know. And I don't think really they're in a position to fully know that either. I mean, this is their judgment based upon what they're told, and they're told by people who don't come to the table without an agenda. And this is part of the problem here. I've absolutely no doubt in my mind that people like Gerry Adams, who is the leader of Sinn Féin, realize that their campaign of violence was going nowhere, and they looked for a political alternative. Now, by a whole series of coincidences and lucky events, he was able to do that. But throughout this process, from the very day that it started all the way up to the formation of the power-sharing government, everyone has been acutely conscious of the fact that there has been an implied threat in the background coming from the IRA, never spoken by people like Gerry Adams, but sort of hanging there in the air unspoken, which is that if this process doesn't work out the way that we like it, well, you know what's going to happen. There's a good chance that we could go back to violence and we could go back to conflict. And throughout this process, which, you know, I think your listeners should be aware has lasted inordinately long period of time. It's lasted longer than American involvement in Vietnam. It's lasted 2.5 times longer than the Second World War, as far as the Europeans were concerned, 39 to 45, and 3 times as long as the First World War, as far as Europeans were concerned, 1914 to 1918. And this is a peace process. And one of the reasons why it's lasted so long is there's been so much doubt about the real intentions of the IRA. And from time to time, they have allowed things to happen, such as bank robberies, such as killings, such as shootings, such as arms smuggling ventures, such as expeditions to the Colombian jungles with people like FARC, which leave that sort of question unanswered. And everyone has been aware that this is part of the leverage that Adams brings to the negotiating table. And that's why this issue is so important. And the reason why it's come up at this particular point in time is that, as your listeners will doubtless be aware, there was a power-sharing government set up in Northern Ireland in the last year and a half or so. And extraordinarily, it was composed of, you know, the Irish equivalent of the Israeli government and Hamas. It was the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, led by that fiery Protestant preacher Ian Paisley, who joined government with the political wing of the Provisional IRA, which had been bombing and shooting for the past 20 or 30 years. And really quite an extraordinary event. A lot of people had a hard time believing it was actually happening, but it came into being. There was one issue that was left unresolved, and that was this local government would eventually at some stage be given powers to control the police force and to oversee the running of the courts, the appointment of judges, the running of the prison service, and so on and so forth. And the question was a group like the IRA coming out of an armed struggle in which they've been killing people, such as policemen and judges, and escaping from jails and trying to destroy jails whenever they could, were they a fit party to have control over the policing system and the justice system? And this report was an attempt to say, from the government's point of view, we believe they are now fit because they're no longer operational as an organization. But while this international independent monitoring commission declared that the leadership of the IRA was no longer operational, that's its top brass, its board of directors, if you like, which is known as the Army Council, composed of 7 people, usually men, who decide the IRA's policy and military and political strategy. While it appears to be redundant, it's still in existence, and that satisfies the monitoring commission and it satisfies the government. But it leaves various questions, you know, hanging in the air. Well, if they're redundant and there's no longer any use for them and they're no operational, then why not just wind them down? Why not just pack your bags and go home? And it's rather like you deciding that you've you're never going to step inside an automobile again. You don't want to drive anymore. It's too dangerous and it's causing problems for the environment. And anyway, gas is far too expensive. But you'll have nothing to do with cars from now on. Why do you still have a car parked outside your door?
Well, that I suppose that invites the question for those people who are concerned about the IRA and about its abandoning of the armed struggle. What exactly would it take to convince those people that, in fact, in the words of the commission, that the provisional IRA has abandoned its terrorist structures, preparations, and capability? I mean, what would the IRA have to do?
Well, there's no real equivalent of sticking your fingers in the wounds here, right? Because none of this is really provable at the end of the day. Lies have been told in the past about paramilitary groups supposedly winding up and ending their activities, and we've discovered that that's not been the case. So, there's a track record there which is not likely to cause much confidence. But I guess what most people are looking for, and certainly what Sinn Féin's political partners in government, Ian Paisley's former party, the Democratic Unionists, are looking for, and I suspect what a lot of their voters and supporters would accept and would certainly look for, would be an announcement that the Army Council has been disbanded, that it no longer exists. Now, it may or may not be the case that it has actually done that, but at least there it is on record that they have disbanded and gone away. And the fact is that in this report, the British and the Irish governments have said, well, actually it hasn't disbanded, but it's no longer doing anything, therefore it's okay. And that's causing a lot of problems for a lot of people.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Ed Maloney. He is a journalist who's been covering Northern Ireland for a long time, since 1978. He's worked for the Irish Times and the Sunday Tribune in Dublin. He has authored several books, including a study of media coverage of the violence in Northern Ireland. He's written for a wide range of papers and magazines in the U.S. and Britain, among them The Washington Post, The Economist, The Independent, The Guardian. He is currently a North American correspondent for the Sunday Times magazine in London and now works in lives in New York. Questions welcome. We're talking about politics of Northern Ireland. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. People who were involved before with the IRA as paramilitaries, have those people essentially just retired, or how many of them have actually become involved in politics and moved on to positions within Sinn Féin?
Well, it seems to be the case that the vast bulk of them have been stood down, if you like. Mm-hmm. And the IMC, the Monitoring Commission report, says that the IRA had various departments, which, had various functions. Like there was a department which would gather intelligence, another department that would gather funds, rob banks and do that sort of stuff. Another one would make explosives, another one that would plan operations. Most of those apparently have been disbanded, right? And their membership are now doing other things, presumably mostly political. But the Monitoring Commission report also says, actually, they are still doing things like gathering intelligence, gathering intelligence on Republican rivals and so on and so forth. Well, that was quite an extraordinary admission to make in the midst of a report which says that these people no longer do anything. Well, if they're not doing anything, what are they doing raising and gathering intelligence, even though it be on rivals who are, along with the British and the Irish government's enemy of the same thing, which is the Good Friday Agreement and the power-sharing government? So most of them, though, to be fair, I think have actually wound up and gone away. But clearly there are some still around there who are still doing IRA-type activities. And there's another huge unanswered question about all of this, which maybe is the real reason why the governments have, at the end of the day, not called on the IRA to disband the ruling Army Council. And it is this. This peace process has lasted, I guess, now something like 14 years or so officially, although it was underway long before that. But in terms of the IRA calling a ceasefire and ending its campaign as we knew it. It started in 1994. That's 14 years. During that 14-year period, they've had the same amount of income coming in every year. And the IRA had an income during the war of something like $10 million a year. So they've had that income still coming in, and their expenditure has been minimal because they haven't been mounting any operations. They haven't been bombing England. They haven't been shooting British soldiers. They haven't been attempting this, that, and the other in Europe or elsewhere. And they've also increased their money-making abilities. For example, everyone will know that, remember, I hope, the robbery of the Northern Bank mm-hmm. in Belfast, something like $60 million, mm-hmm. most of which was never recovered. So where has all this money gone to? Well, I'm told by security forces, and you have to add a caveat there, which is that, where do they get their information from? You don't know. The IRA is not like a commercial company. It doesn't produce annual accounts, so you don't know. There's no way of checking, double-checking the figures. But they say, and it's also supported by the sort of evidence that you pick up on the street in Northern Ireland and elsewhere, that they have, the IRA has an investment portfolio in things like holiday properties in Europe, in Turkey, in Portugal, in the Caribbean, in Britain, in Ireland, and so on and so forth. They have an investment portfolio which is worth the equivalent of $300 to $400 million, which is a nice, small cap company. But it begs all sorts of questions. One is, what do they need this money for? And secondly, who actually owns it? Because, it's legally owned by the IRA. The Army Council is the leadership of the IRA, if you like, it's a board of directors. Can that board of directors vote itself out of existence? And if they do, what happens to the money and who owns it? And I suspect that that's the real reason, or one of the reasons, why the Army Council has not been disbanded and why the two governments are not demanding that it be disbanded, because they're aware of this problem. But none of this, significantly, is addressed in the Monitoring Commission report. And because it's not addressed, it makes me very dubious about what the Monitoring Commission really knows about what's going on. Hmm.
Well, this one of one of these questions that it's posed and answered in this report is the Provisional IRA involved in other illegal activity? And the words here of the report is, we do not think that it is.
So neither is the mafia or the mob these days, David. Las Vegas is now legal. The days of Bugsy Siegel and who else, they've gone. You've now got, respectable commercial legal fronts. We all saw The Godfather Part Two, and that's the way that they were going. And the same thing is happening with the IRA. I mean, they have these investment portfolio in places like Europe and the Caribbean. Composed of villas and hotels and what have you, and they're all legal and they're up front and they pay their taxes. But they're owned by the IRA though.
Mm. Well, that I suppose that also invites the question, and I think that some people would have said for some time that I don't know how far you'd want to go in this, but say at the very least to say that there are people who are operating under the umbrella of the IRA who are truly nothing more than organized criminal gangs.
Mm-hmm.
And some people, I suppose, would say that the IRA was and is an organized criminal gang. Mm-hmm. That kind of activity, does it still continue?
Oh yes, it still continues, and. If you live in areas, for example, in the border between the North and the Republic of Ireland, where a lot, let's say, of smuggling goes on, which is where a good deal of this criminal activity would be centered and where a huge amount of revenue would be raised, everyone knows this would not exist if the IRA did not want it to exist, And there's a very, very strong belief that these groups operate with the approval of the IRA, and in return for which they get a tax, if you like, on the profits that are made by these groups, and that is convenient because it distances the IRA from the activity itself, it makes it difficult to point a finger at them. But everyone knows that it wouldn't happen unless they had given their approval to this, But there are other reasons, though, I think, why. You see, I mean, I come back to this very simple thing. If the Army Council of the IRA is no longer operational, if it doesn't do anything, if it doesn't meet, and if it's redundant, then what the hell is it doing still in existence? Wind it up. I think the fact that it hasn't been wound up, that the governments are refusing to demand that it be wound up, together with the fact that we know about all this money, still leaves open that little nagging doubt in the minds of people who are dealing with the IRA's political wing, Sinn Féin, that, well, maybe they could go back to war, and maybe that $400 million, $300 million, $400 million could be used to buy boatloads of guns and bullets and bombs.
The one of the things that the Irish economy, like the economies of a lot of countries within the last 6 months or so, has been having its difficulties. But having said that, I think that it was thought to be one of the best performing economies in the developed world, at least for a number of years. And I wonder to what extent that if there is a movement. Has been a true, after all these 14 years, a true progress towards having some kind of resolution, whether that has something to do with people in the North looking at the overall prosperity in Ireland and saying, you know, we're missing out on this. And if we can get our house in order, then we can participate more fully in this economic boom that's going on in Ireland as a whole. Is that in fact the case?
Yes, I think it's a factor there, you know, but at the same time, this conflict is very, very, very deep-seated, and there are other issues and other factors that, you know, take precedence against rational thought, such as that which you've just described, which is that it's in their interest, you know, economically to make a peace which increases prosperity and so on and so forth. There's absolutely no doubt that there's a good deal of thought along those lines, but there's a good deal of thought that says, you know, there's really this agreement is there and it's fine, but, you know, we still haven't finally settled this game yet, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it there's a conflict between those two things. Now, it may all become moot because of the economic crisis that we're all in. I mean, the Irish government, you know, officially announced that it's the economy is in recession, and I think it's the first of all the European and Western economies to do so. They've had two quarters of negative growth, and that was just announced a few days ago. And today, the Irish finance minister, the equivalent of Mr. Paulson, made an announcement saying that the crisis was so bad in Ireland that the government was going to guarantee funds. Everyone's funds, whether they be individuals, banks, institutions, what have you, no matter what the limit, not your $100,000, but like if you had $2 million or €2 million in a Dublin bank account, they're going to guarantee that for the next 2 years. That's how serious the crisis is. And yesterday, while we were all watching Wall Street plunge by 6% or 7%, the Irish stock market plunged by 12 or 13%. So, you know, it's while it may have been a factor in some people's minds, I think things have changed somewhat in the last few days.
You talked a little bit earlier about this from a lot of standpoints, remarkable power-sharing agreement that came about, and it involved the DUP and the and Sinn Féin, and the fact that it happened with the blessing and the participation of Ian Paisley, who I suppose if you could think of anyone who would have been on the Protestant side in Protestant political politics, the most outspoken, the strongest opponent of the IRA,
yes.
the guy that you would think never, ever, would this happen, or it would be highly, highly unlikely?
Yeah, his nickname was Dr. No, and he got that nickname for a reason.
Yeah, so when the archetypal Protestant political firebrand, that's this man. What was it that made that possible? Why at that point did it happen?
Well, you see, I think you've first of all got to remove from your mind this notion that the power-sharing government came into power because, you know, people suddenly felt guilty about what had happened, and they decided they had to make friends and start all over again. It didn't really happen like that. It's a power game. It's a power play in a sense. And as far as people like Paisley are concerned, I think they went into power for two basic reasons. First of all, they believed that the deal was of such a nature that it amounted to the political defeat of the IRA and Sinn Féin. And they did so because Sinn Féin has, and the IRA implicitly, has accepted the notion that Northern Ireland's status as a part of the United Kingdom, as being British, cannot change until such time as the majority of people in Northern Ireland i.e. the Protestants, say so. Now, the IRA was set up, certainly in Northern Ireland, in the last 30 years or so, in defiance of that principle. It said, you know, basically the IRA was saying, listen, way back in 1920, the entire population of Ireland voted for independence, and these people up north opted out, and they didn't have a right to do so. And the fact that the British and the Irish governments support their right to do so is a subversion of democracy, so we're going to overthrow this by force of arms. And that was the raison d'etre of the IRA. This deal is based upon, implicitly based and explicitly based upon, the principle of consent, and that's something that the IRA and Sinn Féin have accepted, and DUP looked at that and said, boy, we've won here. We're going to have to share power with these characters, but they've given up their war and they've given up their political aim. No matter what they say in public, this is what the reality is. That was point number one. And point number two, I think, with someone like Paisley, I think it was appealing to his place in history and his ego and so on and so forth. Here was a man who had, been on the outside of the Protestant establishment in Northern Ireland for most of his life, throwing brickbats at the religious establishment and also at the political establishment, always in competition, in conflict with them. And here he ends up, his party overtaking all his former rivals, and he ends up in power as Prime Minister, as First Minister of Northern Ireland, in a deal which he can claim represents victory for him. That's why I think he did it.
Hmm. How much does Britain now have to do with, the British government have to do with the day-to-day running things in Northern Ireland?
Well, they still have a political presence there in Belfast. There is a Secretary of State who, if you like, is the guy who's who's still in charge of important things like the policing system and the courts and the jails and stuff like that. And of course, it is although a power sharing government, it doesn't have full financial or economic independence. It gets a big wad of money from the British Parliament every year to spend, and really their function is to decide who gets the money. All right. Now there are certain rules within which they have to operate, such as certain has to be a certain level of service for education, a certain level of service for health service, and so on and so forth. But essentially, they are administering, if you like, the British Exchequer's contribution to Northern Ireland. So overall, the British still have responsibility for the place. They still have an active role in running it, and they finance it.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a sort of like local government. I suppose it's equivalent to a city government. Let's say here in New York, it would be city government compared to Albany, to the state, that they can spend their money inside New York City, but the budget is decided up in Albany.
Very quickly, we're a little bit past our midpoint here. I'd like for anyone to introduce our guest for this hour, for anyone who might have tuned in last 5 or 10 minutes or more. We're talking with Ed Maloney. He's been a reporter covering Northern Ireland since 1978. He's worked for the Irish Times as Northern Editor and also the Sunday Tribune in Dublin as Northern Editor. He co-authored a celebrated biography of the Reverend Ian Paisley that was first published in 1986, and he then updated and republished it in 2007 in the wake of the power-sharing agreement in Northern Ireland and Paisley's elevation as First Minister. He's contributed to a number of other books, including a study of media coverage of the violence in Northern Ireland. He's written for many papers and magazines in the U.S. and Britain, among them The Washington Post, The Economist, The Independent, The Guardian. He is currently North American correspondent for the Sunday Times magazine in London, but makes his home, lives and works in New York. He's a frequent commentator on BBC, CNN, and also radio and TV in Britain and Ireland. We're talking about Northern Ireland politics. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. It seems to me that there is still one very, very large question here that is yet to be resolved, and I'm not certain how it will be resolved, and that is ultimately what will be the relationship between Northern Ireland, Britain, and the Irish Republic?
We don't know. It'd be a foolish man and a very silly journalist who would make a prediction as to what's going to happen in 20 or 30 years or so. But I do sort of have a feeling, looking at the causes of this conflict and how they've now been addressed, that essentially what you've got is what you're going to have for some long time. And the reason I say that is that the IRA, you know, was viewed in this country and around the world as sort of like an army of national liberation that was trying to free Northern Ireland from British rule and to restore unity to the island of Ireland and, you know, to achieve independence and to finish the job that was, you know, started back in the 1916 rising and so on and so forth. That's what it looked like. The reality underneath, I think, was somewhat different. The reality underneath was that the IRA and its violence represented the feeling on the part of particularly working-class Catholics and nationalists in Northern Ireland that as long as the Unionists were running the show, as long as the Protestants were running the show, they were never going to get a fair swig at the jug, if you like. They were never going to get a square deal from them. And that their campaign of violence was based upon that thought, and that you couldn't reform this place, you couldn't change it, because the Unionists were hopeless bigots. They were like, you know, like antediluvian Civil War people in the southern states. They were like the white South Africans. They were, you know, they were beyond help, beyond reform. Therefore, you destroyed the place in the hope that something better would come along. So in other words, that the roots of the IRA and its violence lay in the fact that there was discrimination against Catholics and that they were treated in the way that they were. And I think what has happened essentially is that the place has been reformed enough that, you know, you now have laws against discrimination. There is now a Catholic middle class in Northern Ireland, which when the trouble started hardly existed. It consisted of a few lawyers and a few pub owners. Now there are professional Catholics all around the place. The government is full of Catholic civil servants and so on and so forth. And this deal sort of institutionalizes all of that change because it gives Catholics in the form of Sinn Féin, who you could argue now represent sort of like a strong, assertive voice of Catholic and nationalist opinion, now have a guaranteed share in government. And having achieved that, the raison d'etre of the IRA, the real raison d'etre, rather than the one that was perceived by the rest of the world, the raison d'etre no longer exists. And that, in other words, what you're going to end up with is a Catholic population that it, feels more at home in Northern Ireland as a British state, which they have a share of, than they ever did before. Therefore, why should it change? Hmm.
We have a caller here. Others are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Someone here calling in from Bourbonnais. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
What is the or what is the regard of the citizenry, of the average citizen, for the IRA and Sinn Féin, and what kind of support do they still have, or even membership, if that's the appropriate way to think of it?
Well, they're a very substantial political party, Sinn Féin is. You know, when this went in various phases, at the very start of the campaign, the IRA would have nothing to do with conventional politics and abhorred it, because that was the road to compromise, and that, you know, previous Irish Republicans had always sold out once they got involved in politics. So they avoided it like the plague. Under Adams's leadership, this all started to change. It started to change in the 1980s when we had hunger strikers being elected to the British Parliament and to the Irish Parliament, and then Sinn Féin adopted a strategy of standing for elections, which they managed to get through their party. And then gradually, bit by bit, you know, their views and their strategy dominated. You know, you've heard, I'm sure, of the description of the IRA's politics, which is an Armalite in one hand and the ballot box in the other. Well, increasingly over the years, the Armalite was displaced by the ballot box. And, of course, as Sinn Féin moved into the peace process, very gradually and very slowly, but obviously going in that direction, more and more Catholics voted for them, A, because they approved, and B, to encourage them to carry on going down that road. And we've ended up in a situation where, in terms of the Catholic or nationalist population in Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin is now the largest single party. But the IRA, as we now know, you know, the Armalite does not really figure. Well, it lurks in the background, but it no longer figures as a player in the game.
Okay, well, that's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. What would the government of the Irish Republic, what would they like to see happen? Is the Irish government essentially content to see things continue as they are now for the foreseeable future?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. This is, from the point of view of both governments, not just the Irish government, this deal that they have got here, one in which, the IRA has effectively defanged itself, something that the British could never have done and the Irish government could never have done, represents all their Christmases coming in one go, and that's why they've backed it so strongly, and that's why they have given so much support to Gerry Adams. It's why Bill Clinton opened the Oval Office to Gerry Adams, and it's why George Bush opened up the White House to Sinn Féin and so on and so forth, because it represents a deal which marks the defeat of terrorism. And this is why, to sort of broaden the conversation a little bit here, given that, the United States in the last 7 or 8 years or so has been faced with a major terrorist conflict, there are lessons to be drawn from that, which I don't think initially the American government was that ready to do so. But I think you're beginning to see hints of that in statements of people like Barack Obama, who's advocating dialogue and so on and so forth. And I think the importance of all that is that there are lessons to be learned from the Northern Ireland situation and how it was resolved. Don't forget, at one stage, and I covered it way back in the 70s and 1980s, Northern Ireland was regarded, alongside the Middle East, as one of those absolutely insoluble problems that would always be there and was beyond help and beyond resolution. But, of course, it's ended up being resolved. And it's been resolved in an extraordinarily final way with the group itself, rather like, Al-Qaeda, winding itself up. The Americans could never achieve that. The Europeans could never achieve that. Only Al-Qaeda could wind themselves up. Well, essentially, that's what's happened here. But the conditions for that happening were encouraged and were nudged along by both governments and by their various agencies. And that's something which the Americans have yet, to learn to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems that this is one of those cases, and maybe in a sense, all of these conflicts are like this, where their people have very, very strong commitment to a particular identity.
Yes.
And sometimes it makes it look as if what conflicts are really all about is competing identities. Now, here, though, it's very clear that economics play a role, because one of the things that was motivating the Catholics in the North was their feeling that they were second-class citizens and they were interested in bettering themselves and having access to the reins of power and participating in government and so forth. So, in a sense, like a lot of other conflicts, this really is about control of resources, about who has political power.
Yeah.
So there are these two things that are both there and that are very important. If you can address the one, if you can address the political side of things, that obviously seems to have happened. But the feeling is that this also is some place where this matter of identity is always going to be extremely strong. Will there always be some potential for conflict around that?
It depends how that issue is addressed. And again, there are still quarrels going on in Belfast about how to do this. But there are ways in which you can, where you have a divided society like that, where you can institutionalize and recognize the cultural and identity differences, for example, in terms of language and so forth. A lot of people who are Catholic and nationalist speak Irish. And one of the things they're looking for is some sort of official recognition, whether that be, street signs in their own districts, through to, some government money to assist research and ensure the survival of the language and so on and so forth. And there are other things that can be done in that particular area. I think that's slightly different, though, than this notion that the identity is expressed and can only be expressed in terms of I want to be in an all-Ireland 32-county republic where there is no British influence. I think people tend to talk like that But do they necessarily mean it? And I don't think they did in Northern Ireland, and that was my argument, is that they went to that extreme because they could see no other halfway house. They could not see these unionists who for years had behaved like South African whites to the blacks. They could not see these people changing, and therefore they had to bring them down, and they expressed, therefore, their politics in the most extreme way, whereas, in fact, they were satisfied with much less. Mm.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Ed Maloney. He's a journalist. He's covered Northern Ireland since 1978. He's worked for the Irish Times, the Sunday Tribune in Dublin. He's contributed to Washington Post, Economist, Independent, Guardian. He's currently a North American correspondent for the Sunday Times magazine in London. He makes his home in New York. We're talking about Irish politics. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. All through this conflict, crimes have been committed by people on both sides. Is it possible that there will be, or has there been some attempt to have some kind of accountability, or will this be a case where people will just have to say, you know, that's the past, there's no going back, we just have to close the door and go on?
Well, funny you should raise that, because that's an issue that is going to be addressed in the very near future, I suspect in the next month or so. Another commission, I mean, Northern Ireland is full of commissions, I'm afraid, but another commission composed of two former high-ranking clerics, one Protestant, one Catholic, who have been sitting down and discussing this notion of how do you deal with the past, you know? Should you have a truth commission, or how else can you address this whole thing? It's a very complicated and very complex issue, because there are some people who would argue that if you had sort of truth commission that you saw in South Africa, the peace process quite simply wouldn't be able to survive it, because details would come out about the past careers of people like Gerry Adams that would curl people's hair, and it would make it impossible for unionists to share power with them. Equally, there would come out in the course of a commission like that assertions and details about security force, police behavior, which would be equally bad and equally horrifying, and that would throw a spanner in the works as well. So the problem is, how do you deal with the past if you can't do that? So we're all waiting to see what these two clerics are going to say, but there's no doubt about it that it's a big issue, because, as you know, there were so many killings there. Small place, admittedly, but in terms of proportionality, it would be like 500,000-600,000 people killed in the United States of America in a civil conflict, and maybe 3 or 4 million people wounded. You'd be talking about a civil war. Well, that small little place had a civil war. Most of these killings are unresolved or unsolved. The people who did them are still walking the streets. People know that. It's a small place. Everyone knows each other. They knew who pulled the trigger, but they can never prove it, and so on and so forth. So it is a big issue. It's a big problem, and it will be there as an open raw wound until such time as that generation dies, I suspect.
Yeah. Well, that you were making reference to the fact that I think one of the things that has come out within the past, I don't know how many years, was that Gerry Adams was involved in the command structure of the IRA at a very, very high level. That's something that he had never admitted to and had always denied.
Yes.
And that here's what you're talking about, if people really knew, had a complete understanding of what his background was, that they'd be horrified. I would have to believe that people would suspect. Now, maybe the thing is that there's a difference between suspecting what he might have done and actually knowing what he might have done would be a big difference.
Yes, all right. But to be fair, Dave, I've also written another book called The Secret History of the IRA, which went into some of these areas, and in particular Gerry Adams' own IRA past. And, of course, he had made it a subject by denying it, right? Which I think was probably a bit foolish from his point of view, because it wouldn't have attracted as much attention. And there's absolutely no doubt that the vast majority of people in Northern Ireland know full well that Gerry Adams was at one stage chief of staff of the IRA, that he was at one stage head of the IRA in Belfast, and that when he was head of the IRA in Belfast, X number of people, 100 people, were killed, and he was giving the orders, for example. Right? But you know, everyone's aware of that, right? But, it, you know, and books like mine come out, and they cause a stir and a controversy for a wee while, and it gets digested into the memories and what have you. And that's there. That's always there. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, the issue of how to deal with the past is such a big factor now. But it's very different when in the context of a solemn court-like proceeding where there are witnesses and cross-examination and so forth, it comes out that Gerry Adams ordered this particular horrific killing or ordered that particular horrific killing, or that the police allowed this one to die or allowed that one to die because they had an informer who was more important than anyone else. You know, that type of thing. When it comes out at that sort of official, it's like, you know, all sorts of rumors fly around the place about the private lives of politicians in the United States. But when it's aired in Congress, you know, when emails to congressional pages get published, it takes on an entirely different and much more serious quality, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what would happen with this.
The people who are involved today in Irish politics, it seems that these are the same people who've been involved in Irish politics now for a long time, and just we've mentioned just two names, Gerry yeah. Adams and Ian Paisley.
Although he's no longer. Paisley has retired now.
And although he has a son, doesn't he?
He
was also very much involved in, sort of took over the mantle from his
yes,
father.
The son is not the father, he's very different, not exactly the same sort of towering character as the father, and will therefore not, I think, occupy the same level of importance as his father.
Well, I guess the question was whether we are now at the point where you're starting to see a younger generation, in a sense, an almost a post-conflict generation, starting to come and be involved in politics.
Oh yes, absolutely. I mean, and it's evident there in the political parties that you know we've just been talking about. If you look, for example, at Sinn Féin, and you go through their top leadership, there's at the very very top, at the Adams level, and the people around him, the people who are sort of the executive, if you like, of Sinn Féin, they've all got IRA records, right? And that's why they're there. But you go below that, and you've got people involved, people getting elected to Parliament, so either north of the border or south of the border, or being involved in county council-type politics, etc., who've never been near a gun in their entire lives, and indeed would run a mile if a gun was ever introduced into the conversation. And they're there for the same sort of political reasons or reasons that other, you know, normal conventional politicians are attracted to the game, which is, you know, power and ego and all that sort of stuff and opportunity. And Sinn Féin offers that. And that in itself has a transforming impact on their politics, because the more you, as it were, change your membership away from the hardline zealots and revolutionaries to the pragmatists and people who, you know, are quite happy with compromise and who have other priorities, such as getting a ministerial job or getting this, that, and the other passed through the parliament, that dilutes their politics, it dilutes their zealotry, and it changes them. And that's what's happening in Northern Ireland. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And equally, it's happening on the unionist side. But, you know, at the same time, we come back to where we started off in this conversation about whether or not the IRA still exists. It's still my view that executive, composed of people who are, you know, in the IRA and active in the IRA, know that at the ultimately, once if it was announced tomorrow that the Army Council had been disbanded and no longer existed, where would Adams's leverage be in the political negotiations? He's always had a gun underneath the chair when he's sitting at the table. Mm-hmm. It's not there physically, but it's there metaphorically, and everyone knows that. And that's, I think, the problem about this declaration that the Army Council, you know, is redundant. Well, you know, if it's redundant, it should go. And it's not gone, and therefore, because it's not gone, it's still part of the negotiations, and it's still part of the problem. And I think until such time as you actually get rid of it and you get everyone on the same equal and level playing field, you're still going to have problems. And, for example, over this argument over whether policing should be given to the local parliament or not, as a result of that, the government has not met since June, and it may collapse. There's a possibility that it may collapse. I don't think it will, but it could. It wouldn't collapse, though, if the Army Council was announced to have been disbanded. I think that would change it.
One last question, and I'm afraid we'll have to be brief. You have about a minute, but living as you do in New York, I'm sure that you know in New York and in the Northeast, I expect there are probably a lot of Americans who are closely identify with Ireland and follow Irish politics. To what extent have Irish Americans been involved in either perpetuating this conflict or trying to move things in the direction of a solution?
Well, they've done both. You know, over the years, they contributed huge amounts of money, and they also sent over arms and explosives and weapons. I mean, they sent over the Armalite rifle in the 1970s to Gerry Adams in Belfast, and made the Belfast Brigade of the IRA a better armed unit than the British Army. But they've also, of course, been involved in the peace process at a different level. You know, the people who were sending over the Armalites lived in the Bronx. The people who are helping Sinn Féin in the ceasefire now are in Wall Street and Park Avenue. That's the difference. They've gone into the Irish-American corporate levels, as it were, to make these changes. So in different ways, very different ways, and different types of people, Irish-Americans have been very deeply involved, both in the war and in the peace.
Yeah. Our guest, Ed Maloney, he's been covering Northern Ireland since 1978. He is currently American correspondent for the Sunday Times magazine in London. If you're interested in reading about Irish politics, there are a couple of books that you might look at. He has authored a biography of Ian Paisley, first published in 86 and then republished, updated in 2007. The other book, which I neglected to mention, and I'm so sorry, is the book A Secret History of the IRA. That was first published in 2002, and a second edition of that was published last year, 2007. Mr. Maloney, thanks very much for talking
to us. My pleasure. My pleasure.